My main man, Obadiah, after 2,600 long years, I think it's high time that you go viral. Welcome to the Cutting the Gordian Knot podcast. Yes, we are talking about the much-ignored Book of Obadiah. This episode can kind of be thought of as a Jacob and Esau, Episode 2, The Empire Strikes Back. And on that Star Wars note, some say that Obi-Wan Kenobi is actually short for Obadiah One Kenobi. Well, by some, I mean just me. But before we dive right into this actually fantastic book, we're going to need a little bit of background. So I mentioned how this could be like a Jacob and Esau part two. Much of this prophecy is condemning a little nation called Edom. Now, Edom is the nation which came from the line of Esau. And of course, Israel is the nation that came from the line of Jacob. So the battle between these two continues in this book. And Edom has been doing some pretty messed up stuff. They were cruel to Israel as they came out of Egypt and they're wandering in the desert and they don't have a great ability to defend themselves or care for themselves. Well, Edom exploited them. They also, once they got into the Promised Land, were raided by Edom. And at more than one point, I believe, they sided with the Philistine enemies against their own brother nation. At one point, they were conquered by Israel and made into a vassal state. That's just how bad it got. They had to do that. And at this point, what's really the last straw? Because Babylon rolled in to conquer and drag away as captives the nation of Israel. And Edom not only stood by while their brother nation was being attacked and plundered and dragged away into slavery, but they actually sided with Babylon, and they took this opportunity to loot and to destroy and to even kill fugitives who were trying to escape Israel and killed them just for funsies. So they're a really bad nation at this point. They're rightly condemned. And that's what the whole Book of Obadiah is about. It's about the size of maybe one small chapter of any other book. So we'll be able to read through the entire thing. A little bit of Jewish tradition, which is actually helpfully summarized by the good people of Wikipedia. We learn that, quote, according to the Talmud, Obadiah is said to have been a convert to Judaism from Edom. So he's actually an Edomite. And he's a descendant of Eliphaz, the friend of Job. And we'll talk about him a little bit later. He's identified with the Obadiah who was the servant of Ahab. And from what I can tell, he's actually the not just a servant, but the ruler of the house, much like Joseph was the ruler of the house for Potiphar and later for Pharaoh. So Obadiah seems to be the ruler of the house for King Ahab, that bad king married to Jezebel. All right, moving on here. And he's later, of course, chosen to prophesy against Edom because he himself is an Edomite. Wikipedia continues, Obadiah is supposed to have received the gift of prophecy from having hidden the 100 prophets from the persecution of Jezebel. He hid the prophets in 2 caves so that if one of those caves would be discovered, then the ones in the other could escape. Obadiah was very rich, but all his wealth was expended in feeding the poor prophets until, in order to be able to continue to support them, finally he had to borrow money at interest from Ahab's son, Jeroboam. Obadiah's fear of the Lord was believed to be 1 degree higher than that of Abraham. And if the house of Ahab had been capable of being blessed, it would have been blessed for Obadiah's sake. So that's their summary of some of the Jewish tradition. And some of that, what it mentioned, like the Obadiah who's seen in the court of Ahab, that's mentioned in, I think, 2 Kings 20-ish or so. Other things we learn are that Obadiah is a contemporary of the prophet Elijah. That is, if this is the same Obadiah that's written the book and was mentioned in Kings. The scholar Peter Lanehart points out, and I quote, that Obadiah and Elijah radically differ in their position and mode of service. Whereas Elijah confronts Ahab from outside of the court, Obadiah works for the preservation of the prophets from within Ahab's court. So this was our inside man in a very, very wicked government. He's stealthily working from the inside of the court to protect good, to thwart evil and to hide the people who would have been killed. So I mentioned there is some question about if this is the right Obadiah. By some counts, there are actually 13 Obadiahs mentioned in the Bible. And heck, by our count earlier, there's even one mentioned in Star Wars. And this ought not be terribly surprising because his name simply means servant of God or worshiper of God. So essentially, it's the Old Testament equivalent of being named Steve. All right, so Obadiah is unexpectedly awesome. He's rich. He saved those 100 prophets. He thwarted the king to the extent he was able. He tried to stop the super evil wife of Ahab, Jezebel, from killing all sorts of good people. He was a convert from the Edomites to the true faith. He ruled the house of the king, and he may have been a tick more fearful of God than Abraham himself. He's best buds with Elijah, doing that inside-outside game, and he's a descendant of Job's not terribly helpful friend. He's the guy here, we think, who's writing the prophetic slam against Edom. That in one section may have been quoted by none other than Jeremiah and Ezekiel in chapters 49 and 25, respectively. So the really big name prophets, when they talk about Edom, like to use Obadiah at least as source material because, well, they think that he really nailed it. And as we see, he definitely did. And this has a lot to say about what happens in the New Covenant, too. But we'll get to that. All right. The beginning of Obadiah. It's titled The Vision of Obadiah. And we're going to stop right here. Because many prophetic books begin with, the word of the Lord came to fill in the blank. But here, he sees a vision. And it's interesting to note that his ancestor derives the certainty of his advice from a dream that he had, and then he uses that advice to go and bother Job. But here we see that God's at work with his descendant, Obadiah, and Obadiah gets a bit of an upgrade. He too sees something, but he's awake. And what he sees is actually something pretty similar to what his forefather saw. His forefather, Eliphaz, saw that God brings justice, but he mistakenly thought that God always brings justice immediately. And finally, in this life. Obadiah doesn't think that. In fact, he will open up this idea of the day of the Lord. Some say he's the first one to point it out, but I don't necessarily think that's true. That's not quite the right chronology. Some, I think, Ezekiel and Hosea beat him to it. I don't know. Other people beat him to it. But it's quite prominent here, given that there are only a few points that he makes in this very short book, and he brings up the day of the Lord as the thing in which we're putting our hope for the final vindication. That means that this is at the forefront of his thought. So he sees that God will indeed avenge the sins that the wicked have done to the righteous, but it will be in the day of the Lord, this future point where God himself will set things right. This is correcting the error of his forefather who told Job that bad things happen immediately to bad people. Therefore, Job, yeah, must be bad. Continuing. This is what the Sovereign Lord says about Edom. We have heard a message from the Lord. An envoy was sent to the nations to say, rise, let us go against her for battle. See, I will make you small among the nations. You will be utterly despised. Now, one thing that this does right from the start is, remember the context, is big, powerful Babylon is coming to bully small, innocent Israel. And oftentimes, in a modern society, we take this oppressor versus oppressed paradigm for just being how we detect good and evil. There's one side, which is weak and vulnerable, and they must be the good guys. And whoever is big and powerful, well, they must be the bad guys. But from the very start, we see this being shaken up a bit, because God curses Edom to be small and utterly despised, and they're evil. And then we also have Babylon, who are big and utterly despised, and we have Israel, who, well, they were being jerks, but eventually they become righteous, but small. However, they're promised to be large, and later on in the prophecy, we see that there's going to be this going out of this goodness, so they'll be large and good. So it breaks up this idea that we should be just always siding with either the person who came to power as if might made makes right. That's false. But it also counters the error that whoever's small and weak and vulnerable is always the good guy, because that can be false too. Here we see that God curses Edom to be small among the nations and to be utterly despised precisely because they are evil. So it's shaking up either the paradigm of might makes right, or the paradigm of the oppressor versus oppressed narrative is how we understand who's right and wrong. We're told instead to judge rightly. And that's something ultimately only God can do on the day of the Lord. All right, let's keep going. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rocks and make your home on the heights, you who say to yourself, who can bring me down to the ground? So the nation of Edom is actually quite mountainous, and they're using this place of safety, the cleft in the rock, not to do what Moses did when he was hidden in the cleft of the rock, to see God, to use this as a place of privileged encounter of their creator. No, they're not doing that. And they're also not using this cleft of a rock in the way that David did, to lean on the protection of God, to be made safe from his enemies. But instead, they're using this to serve themselves, to rely on their own purported wisdom, and to use it as a place of safety from which to go and plunder their neighbor. So they are entirely perverting the point, or the place that they're established here. They're using it in absolute opposition to God and neighbor. I think you also notice that the pattern which is described for Edom is very similar to what's described as the fall of Satan. So they say, who can bring me down to the ground? Well, the answer is, God can. He can smash the devil into the dust of the earth from the heights of heaven, and it's silly that these people think that he can't drag them out of their mountains. And indeed, the prophecy goes on to say that that will happen, that they will be crushed. So this type of pride leads them to this idea of invincibility, the idea that they can't possibly be pushed down from their heights, but of course, that is false. Though you soar like the eagle and make your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. Eagle is not always eagle in the Bible. In fact, the best way to typically look into this word, though I didn't look at it in Obadiah specifically, but it's normally targeting vultures. So that's what eagle is typically being rendered from. It means vulture. And I think that is absolutely what we need to be thinking of. They are soaring around like vultures. They see that there's been a great battle, many are dead, and now they think that it's their time to plunder, to take, to eat up all of the stuff that they find as a result of this terrible battle. It also says that they're making their nest among the stars. So they're making it like this cozy home from which to propagate among the stars. Now, usually when you read stars in scripture, it's in connection with the angels. Now, this isn't just because of their cosmology back in the day, but we also have some just metaphorical allusion throughout other prophetic books. We're told that a third of the stars fall from heaven. We're told that in the Gospel of Matthew, and that's pointing towards the angels that fell from heaven. They're pointed to as stars. So I think this is saying is that they have perched themselves in this cozy little place from which they think they can go out and propagate, in which they live in the company of demons, where they're in an association of just false ideas, evil thoughts, terrible temptations, and they're siding with not only the enemy powers which are terrestrial, but also the enemy powers which are angelic, well, in this case, demonic. So it's pointing out that there's a twofold association, that you're linking yourself with your own evil desires of self-aggrandizement, you're linking yourself with the foreign powers that have come to oppress your neighbors, and you're making your home nice and comfy cozy in the presence of the demonic. If thieves came to you, if robbers in the night, oh, what a disaster awaits you. Would they not steal only as much as they wanted? If grape pickers came to you, would they not leave a few grapes? But how Esau will be ransacked, his hidden treasures pillaged. All your allies will force you to the border. Your friends will deceive and overpower you. Those who eat your bread will set a trap for you, but you will not detect it. So what God's saying here is that the evil things that they have done to Israel will indeed come back on them. So this gives us a little bit of clue of what they've done to Israel. They've gone past just helping themselves to the things that they would like. For instance, taking the grapes out of the vineyards or stealing a few things which catch their eye. But it shows that they were actually in a type of friendship, an alliance. So they had this inside knowledge. They were able to systematically uncover hidden treasures to injure the other. This is a type of betrayal of trust. And Obadiah is busy doing the exact opposite, recall. He's on the inside of a wicked kingdom trying to make it holy. But here in his prophecy, he's decrying these people who have come on the inside to steal, to plunder, and specifically to harm their neighbor in a way that not even somebody who's simply selfish would do, in a way that's just demonically powered, in a way that's truly, truly wicked. In that day, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom, those of understanding in the mountains of Esau? So what are they up to in the mountains? Turns out that they're doing a lot of copper mining and smelting. I think they did iron too. So it seems that these guys were fairly well organized and pretty technologically sophisticated for their time. They're actually also known to be pretty wise guys, pretty smart dudes. To kind of give a modern equivalent, I might say that they're like the tech bros of today. They're making very useful stuff, they're highly productive, they're at the edge of technology, and they're regarded as wise, even if they're not. So they kind of have this halo effect, I would say, that because they can provide this stuff for the nations around and take on this pretty challenging work to do all the smelting and refining, etc., they're just believed in general to be right about other things. But it turns out that they're desperately wrong and that they've used their wisdom to search out the treasures of a victim nation just to exploit. So whatever they have right here, they seem to be turning over to evil. Your warriors, Taman, will be terrified, and everyone in Esau's mountains will be cut down in the slaughter. Because of the violence against your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. You will be destroyed forever. On the day you stood aloof while strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. You should not gloat over your brother in the day of his misfortune, nor rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor boast so much in the day of their trouble. You should not march through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor gloat over them in their calamity, in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth in the day of their disaster. You should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor hand over their survivors in the day of their trouble. That's some pretty harsh stuff that they've been doing. Handing over survivors to the enemy nation in the day of their trouble and cutting down fugitives that they find, seizing their wealth in the day of their disaster. So let's kind of turn to how this whole thing started. And you can listen back to the Jacob and Esau episode. And another companion episode is the Church and State, I think episode 3 on friendship. That's what I want to talk about here. I'm quite confident that the particular sin that targets friendship is envy. So friendship gathers around a good thing for mutual appreciation. It allows different perspectives of the good thing to be shared so that we can learn to appreciate things to a greater degree. You know, see Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics for the details. Now, envy perverts and attacks this. Proverbs calls envy a rottenness to the bones. The book of James calls it a bone cancer. So it attacks the very structural integrity of the body. And I'll add, it kills the ability to make new blood, right? That's what bone cancer does. It shuts down and corrupts the mechanism by which the body transfers resources internally through active transport. So envy, hating that the other has a good thing, is a sorrow at the good fortunes of others. And we do see that in our society. We hear people today chanting at rich people's mansions to eat the rich. But in yesteryear, rich people would have their houses open for curious visitors to conduct tours for. In Pride and Prejudice, right? That book that every woman under 16 is probably reading right now. What do the people do at Pembroke? Well, they go over to Mr. Darcy's house for a tour because that's expected. It's a beautiful mansion, so it's kind of opened up so that many people can come in friendship to enjoy the good thing that's there. That's a properly ordered society. One where people have sorrow and anger at the good fortune of others, that's a very destructive society. Now, Aristotle points out explicitly that the state is based on friendship. And he makes a further point that where there is friendship, law is not needed because people are friends. An example of this is the Jewish diamond trade, where bazillion-dollar transactions are being done on handshakes and verbal contracts. There's no need for the court system. There's no need for all this crazy verification because there's trust. There's a strong community. There's actually a friendship there. So the need for all of this law, this isn't there. And all the costs associated mean, well, they have this incredible advantage over everybody else that they don't have to pay the verification costs because they trust one another. That's the type of example of where law just drops away because friendship is there. Now, the converse is also true. Where friendship is lost, there must be force and coercion by the state. So it goes like this. Envy breaks friendship. Excuse me. And why does it do that? Because again, friendship gathers around these common goods and enjoys them. It says, I have this, and you say, I have that, and you enjoy it together. But if you have sorrow at this, you can't enter into friendship. So envy breaks friendship. And then law must come in to replace friendship. And the state must be there to enforce the law. And laws are ultimately enforced by violence. So that's what happens when envy has its full flowering, is it turns into a despotic state, which is absolutely permeated with violence. My case in point is the Soviet Union. Some people, particularly at the time of the Soviet Union, point out that there is a phrase, honest as a German, because there were a fair amount of German immigrants who had come into Russia, and they carried just a garden variety European culture where they didn't lie, like not normally. And Russians took note of this, thinking that this was weird. This was strange. Their culture was that, yeah, you lie all the time. It was a culture of distrust, not friendship. And of course, if you know anything about the way this whole thing started, it started in a giant convulsion of envy with the Bolshevik Revolution, where workers were told to be envious, where all of the slights and past injustices were put before their eyes so that they could hate, so that they could envy, so that they could have a deep sorrow and hatred for everything that anybody had that was more than what they had. And that destroys societies. So what we learn is that we see Edom having envy for its neighbor. We saw earlier that Esau is envious of Jacob. And this breaks this union of friendship. And this slides all the way into this terrible, evil, violent betrayal, which Obadiah is decrying. So in short, turning to envy is a betrayal of your community. It's a betrayal of your nation. And in this case, it can actually be an international betrayal. And it is actually siding with the enemy in that it sides with the forces that destroy our nation. We see here Edom is in league with the demons. with the evil foreign powers, and with all the forces that come to destroy and maim. So, quick reminder, don't be envious. Don't buy into a lot of the economic preaching that we hear today talking about income inequality, because the little smooth brains who decry all this stuff don't even understand their own numbers. So go and listen to some of my economic myths episode if you are concerned about that. Never looked into it. Don't worry, I looked into it for you. And if you have any questions, email me and we can hit those more. But that's a place where envy is being stirred up now. People lying about income inequality and distorting numbers and twisting things and being in league with the demons who only lie in order to make all of society collapse. And of course, all the crazy racial things going on, preaching to people that they need to focus on the oppression and the history of grievances. Instead, they should be telling dads to stay in their home and telling people to pick up books and put down crack pipes and things which actually lead to a flourishing community. So whenever you hear the voice of the Edomites, the voice which preaches envy, the voice which betrays the society and seeks its destruction, send up a prayer to our man Obadiah, because he knows how to work from the inside, even in an evil society, to try to protect the good and bring about justice. And even if that doesn't happen immediately, we get to look forward, as he did, to the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. Just as you drank on my holy hill, so all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and drink and be as if they have never been. And thank God, God's judgment for all the evil, for all the envy, for all the violence, for all these things which disrupt our world, thank God, God is going to judge this. And it is eternally coming soon. Let's learn about some more good news here. But on Mount Zion will be deliverance. It will be holy. And Jacob will possess his inheritance. Jacob will be a fire, and Joseph a flame. Esau will be stubble, and they will set him on fire and destroy him. There will be no survivors from Esau. The Lord has spoken. So the best thing we can hope for, of course, is the repentance of the wicked. That is our number one pick, and it has to be. But the second best, maybe even a close second, is their death and destruction. And here we see this hope, that Esau has refused repentance, its sin has fully flowered, and now it says Esau will be stubble, and they will set him on fire and destroy him, and there will be no survivors. The Lord has spoken. So this is a punishment of the evil for the deeds that they've done, but it's also a promise of deliverance. A promise that deliverance will come on Mount Zion. What does that mean? What happened? Pop quiz. What happened on Mount Zion? Christ's death? Nope, wrong mountain. His resurrection? Nope, that was somewhere else. But something else very important happened. Let me read you something from good old Pope Francis. This is a very short speech that he had when he was visiting Mount Zion some years ago. This is him speaking. It is a great gift that the Lord has given us by bringing us here together in the upper room for the celebration of the Eucharist. Here, where Jesus shared the Last Supper with the apostles, where after his resurrection he appeared in their midst, where the Holy Spirit descended with power upon Mary and the disciples, where the church was born, and was born to go forth. From here she set out, with the broken bread in her hands, the wounds of Christ before her eyes, and the spirit of love in her heart. In the upper room, the risen Jesus, sent by the Father, bestowed upon the apostles his own spirit, and with this power he set them forth to renew the face of the earth. To go forth and to set out does not mean to forget. The church, in her going forth, preserves the memory of what took place here. The Spirit, the Paraclete, reminds her of every word and every action that reveals true meaning. The upper room reminds us of sharing, fraternity, harmony, and peace among ourselves. How much love and goodness has flowed from the upper room. How much charity has gone forth from here like a river from its source, beginning as a stream and then expanding and becoming a great torrent. All the saints drew from this source, and hence the great river of the church's holiness continues to flow from the heart of Christ, from the Eucharist, from the Holy Spirit. Lastly, the upper room reminds us of the birth of the new family, the church, established by the risen Jesus, a family that has a mother, the Virgin Mary. Christian families belong to this great family, and in it they find the light and strength to press on and be renewed amid the challenges and difficulties of life. All God's children of every people and language are invited and called to be part of this great family as brothers and sisters and sons and daughters of this one Father in heaven. Boom. Good job, Pope Francis. You nailed it. I like this very much. And keep all of what he said in mind as we hit the very end of Obadiah. I keep exactly that. People from the Negev will occupy the mountains of Esau, and people from the foothills will possess the land of the Philistines. They will occupy the fields of Ephraim and Samaria, and Benjamin will possess Gilead. This company of Israel, of Israelite exiles who are in Canaan, will possess the land as far as Zephirath. The exiles from Jerusalem who are in Shephard will possess the towns of the Negev. Now this is the key verse. Deliverers will go up on Mount Zion to govern the mountains of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. Here I think that these prophesied deliverers that set off from Mount Zion to govern even the mountains of Esau, such that the kingdom will be the Lord's, I believe that this is a prophecy of the apostles sent out from the upper room on Mount Zion. What this is preaching about is a reoccupation of the places of darkness. What it's talking about is the reoccupation which comes from the church when the rulers, the governors of this new kingdom are sent from Mount Zion by our God. That, I think, makes Obadiah a top-tier prophet. Not only does it speak all the way to the end of time, the day of the Lord, but it also speaks of the Messiah and the Messiah's kingdom and the rulers which will be sent out of the place where indeed they were sent, from the very birthplace of the church. Here's a few other things I want to point out. As you remember from the Jacob and Esau episode, there's a deep typological connection between Esau and John the Baptist. So Esau, of course, was not meant to be evil. He was meant to be good, but he chose evil. John the Baptist is like a new Esau. He's of that same type. And Jesus takes on the role of the new Jacob. And we got into that in that episode. But for one thing, we have Jacob gathering all the 12 tribes, and Jesus gathers the 12 disciples. And there's much, much more. Okay, we're going to have to skip that. But we got new stuff here about the connection between John the Baptist and Esau. Now, Jesus, being the new Jacob, is the real definitive king of Israel. He's opposed, he opposed the rulers of his time and is killed. So Jesus is punished unjustly in connection with Israel. But interestingly, we have John the Baptist. He seems to be taking the place of Esau. He seems to take on the dysfunction of Edom. And he bears the cost of the prophetic judgment against the new Edomites. And this punishment is, to quote Obadiah, your deeds will return upon your own head. So just as Jesus identifies with Israel and gets punished with death, John the Baptist goes and he confronts the evil of Edom. And he is killed. It comes upon his own head as he is beheaded. So why do I say that he opposes this Edomite king? Well, Although Jesus goes against the rulers of Israel, John the Baptist gets in trouble because he's going against King Herod. And Herod is an Edomite. So he's a king who is an Edomite. That is who the new Esau, John the Baptist, opposes. And I'll add that we have, back in Obadiah's time, a evil woman, Jezebel, who gets the king to go and kill the prophets. All right? What happens in the New Testament? Well, there's that dancing girl that comes along. Herod gets booty blinded, makes the terrible promise he'll give her up to half the kingdom, and then she asks for the head of John the Baptist. So a woman comes, moves the heart of the king to kill the prophet. So that's an exact match to what's going on in the time of Obadiah. And I think that's also shows that connection shows that the Obadiah who wrote this is quite likely also the Obadiah who is mentioned in Kings and is the one that's held up in Jewish tradition. There's one more connection, which I find is interesting. We have our man Obadiah writing this condemnation of Edom. We find out that he is an Edomite, but he converted. And he's buried. And he's buried with great honor in a place called Sebastia, which is the same place where the early Christians decided to lay the remains of John the Baptist. So, another deep connection between John the Baptist's role in taking on Edom, in dealing with the sin which came from Esau, just as Jesus is taking on the house of Israel. Quite the tag team, guys. All right, so to sum all this up, why ought Obadiah go viral after these long, long 2,600 years? Well, one, because it focuses our hope on the day of the Lord. And Job needed that, but he didn't get it from his friend. And yet his descendant does see this clearly, that God will return punishment for the wicked deeds, but it's not always immediately. His grandfather, Obadiah's great-great-grandfather, who's friends with Job, he confuses the idea of people flourishing and they must be good, and people who are punished and they must be bad. But Obadiah sees past that. He understands that God judges the heart, and that whether you're oppressed or the oppressor, you could be good or you could be evil. See, he has a correction of what his ancestor had. And he presents that to us with this focus on the day of the Lord. I also like that it confidently prophesies the rulership of the apostles in connection to the sacramental economy instituted by Christ on Mount Zion to go and reoccupy, to go and retake the world. It reminds us that we shouldn't leave our neighboring nations in peril or focus only on our own gain instead of defending our brothers from tyranny and oppression. This is one of the few books of the Bible which actually comes to bear on foreign policy. We also see that this book opens up the destructive power of the sin of envy that first gripped Esau and finally slew Edom. And I think it serves as a warning about how that destructive power can strike our own civilization. We also learned how John the Baptist is connected even more deeply to the archetype of an unfallen Esau than we knew before. And we're given a warning against those who fancy themselves wise just because of technical improvements. If they've cut themselves off from the faith, then what they end up doing is losing the moral clarity to have anything more than, at best, a bland pacifism in the face of evil, but at worst, a predatory and scavenging selfishness exploiting other people in their misfortune. So it's a reminder that, yes, technical achievements are important and they're great, but we shouldn't just give a halo effect to anybody who can do a technical feat of coolness. Instead, we have to link that in and ally it with our faith so that it doesn't turn to self-destruction. There's greater metal workers in Israel than Edom. Those who made the temple and all the beautiful things inside of it were actually inspired by the very Spirit of God working through them. And of course, our Lord was born into a family where his father is a carpenter, somebody who can make things, and I bet a lot better than the Edomites, but it's in union with the faith, and that's how it actually comes to flourish. Finally, I think by learning about Obadiah, we're given somebody who's very interesting and important figure to emulate. He's somebody who fears God, and tradition is saying maybe even a bit more than Abraham, which is unbelievable, especially from a Jewish perspective, to say that anybody fears God more than Abraham. That's getting a little bit far out there, but that's what's said. And look what he's doing. He's actually serving in a king's court in a thoroughly corrupt administration, but he's using his position and his shrewdness to protect the people of God. We see a rich man in Obadiah, but he loves the truth and he loves his neighbors even more than money. So he chooses to go in debt to an evil prince before he chooses to let the prophets under his care starve. So this is somebody who's wielding his wealth and his power all the way to the end to protect God's people, his plan, and his purposes in a very shrewd way, not just giving up his position saying, I'm going to wash my hands of this evil political environment. No, he jumps right in. And yet he fears God throughout. That's an incredible man to emulate, especially in a society where there is a lot of chaos and evil and dysfunction. We need more Obadiahs who can actually wade into that terrible, evil environment and somehow draw out good, draw out protection for the people who need it. All right, we're going to take a brief break, and we are going to hit the mailbag, and we're going to hit it hard. The mailbag. All right, question one, guys. How does mental illness affect the moral life? You can plead insanity in court, but is there still moral accountability that they hold? I want to say that they might not be accountable, but it seems crazy that somebody might never act in a moral or immoral way if they're disabled or ill their entire life. I just doubt that would be possible. All right. Well, I think in some select cases, yeah, you just might not really be a moral agent. For instance, like severe mental retardation or some type of psychological state whereby you are entirely disconnected with reality and your rational faculties. That could be, but I want to get more into this. All right, let's get into my probably not nuanced enough answer. So if there's any residual questions, let me know and I'll see if I can answer it further. But I want to point out that the law of Moses makes a distinction between intentional and unintentional sin. We covered that a lot in the Leviticus episode. And that's kind of interesting. I think it strikes us a bit weird, particularly those of us who grew up in a Protestant world. The idea of an unintentional sin is kind of weird. It doesn't even seem like a sin at all. Now, sin always includes a movement of the will. So in that sense, everything is intentional. And it's a movement towards a lower good instead of a higher good. So it's a misordering in the hierarchy of goods. Now, an intent is always present in any type of choice like that. However, there's a difference between knowing that you are sinning and choosing that, and simply not understanding the hierarchy of goods correctly, and choosing in a way which places the lower good above the higher good. Now, doing the following is not as grave as knowing that one is doing evil and yet doing it anyway. But still, the action of choosing lower goods at the expense of higher goods, even if you don't know that you're doing evil, is forming a habit. And when we allow those habits to form, we are unknowingly disordering ourselves internally. And that's what it looks like to have an unintentional sin. There is a movement of the will. The will is necessary in order to sin. At least maybe there's some crazy theological thing I don't know. But yes, it is. But the extent that you are culpable changes based on the understanding of those goods which you apprehend. So in the sacrifice in the Old Covenant, people participate in something to correct not just the sins which they knew were sins, but in all the ways in which they were being internally disordered by these different habits. And today, we are justified by Christ infusing into us his grace, chiefly through the sacraments. And this is a big difference between like Reformed and much of Protestant thought and Catholic thought. So I want to give a bit of an analogy here. So let's say your life is like a house, and let's say it ought to be clean. Intentional sin would be like you held a rave at your home and now it's trashed and you have to dust all the cocaine off the countertops and bag up all the crumpled beer cans and, you know, use needles tossed across the floor. That would be intentional sin. The problem is that your house is very disordered. The solution is justification, to make right, to realign things, to clean up this house. Now, unintentional sin would be like you left your windows open on a nice but windy day, and the wind sweeps through, blowing all of your hundreds of papers you needed to file your taxes that year off of your kitchen table and across your entire home in a mess of paperwork chaos. So what's the problem? Disorder. What's the solution? What's justification? It's to put it right. It's to realign everything. So what matters ultimately is the objective disorder and the objective solution. So in Reformed and much of Protestant thought, which sometimes creeps its way into the Catholic consciousness, it focuses not on the objective mess internal, but only on the cause. And here's the thing. No one's going to walk into their house and see the papers and declare, you know what? I'd say it's clean. No, it's clean. Because, wait for it, it was not my fault. It was the wind's fault. I didn't know better. Therefore, I shall declare this house clean. No, you wouldn't do that. You'd understand that, sure, it was not your intent and it's not technically your fault, but it's still objectively disordered and it needs to be reordered. So that's how we can view this type of unintentional sin. So God didn't just come to clean our house from the stuff that we purposefully did to ruin it. The good news is he also came to clean up our houses from the ways that we unintentionally ruined it, or the ways that we were ruined by others. So God's infusion of grace is about forgiving our purposeful sin. Yes, that's important, but that's not all. It's just a stop along the way to his real goal, which is to make us a new creation in him for eternal and perpetual beatitude, union with God himself. That's the point. So for those with a mental disorder, it is possible that they have no intentional sin. But that doesn't mean that their actions are morally neutral because of the objectivity of the mess that they could create. So let's say that we could have like a true, out-of-his-mind, crazy psychopath. 100% nuts, all right? So he's out of his mind and he goes on to murder lots of people. He sees people, everybody with a blue shirt, he decides to stab in the face. Does he need God's grace to undo this habit of stabbing people in the face? Yes, he absolutely does. Does he need salvation? Yes, he absolutely does. Why? Because even if this was not his willful intention, even if he was completely inculpable from that type of sin because of his wild mental illness, God wishes to not just clean up the things which he messed up, but clean up the ways in which he was messed up, or the habits which were created unintentionally, which are disordered. So the bottom line is, no, you are not always morally accountable for intentional sins, but you are morally accountable for unintentional sin in the sense that your interior mess must be remedied, even if that involves pain. So I hope that answers it. Finally, I'll throw in one more thing. In the Jonah episode, I reflected on St. Jerome's interpretation of the beasts wearing sackcloth and ashes and repenting. The way he understood this was that these were people who are not mentally capable of understanding reason very well. But we see in Jonah that these two participated in repentance. Why? Well, they did it because they too have a duty to plead to God to be infused with the grace that sets us right again, whether or not we can understand it. So, yes, there we go. That's my answer. Next question is, I'd be interested to hear more details about your lobbying efforts that you've done over the years. Well, the truth is there weren't that many lobbying efforts at all, and it was a number of years ago. So I used to set up some meetings with candidates who were running for like state house or Congress, and I'd chat with them. And a couple of them I would meet with repeatedly. One lady who was running, I gave her I think two or three part, like 3 hour each, economic crash course. And kind of served as the unofficial economic advisor to any type of stuff that she'd be receiving from the party that was economic related. She'd send over to me and I'd just do a write up of, hey, here's how it would play out. This is what's recommended, not recommended. So did that for a bit. Wrote a series of short articles, sent them, and bothered my state reps with them. I guess the one success I had, I kind of regret. So I flipped the key vote in Virginia for the health subcommittee, this is years ago now, to legalize types of marijuana in Virginia. And the argument that was successful with this particular person was that one of the number one reasons why dads were no longer in the home was because they were arrested for drug offenses. And I said, listen, I don't like drugs. In my ideal world, I wouldn't have anybody doing drugs. But here's the thing. I like fatherhood more than I like the justice of locking people up for smoking a doobie. So, I think we should make that trade, and I think it's better for society. And I think, ironically, we're actually promoting family values by making sure that dads have every opportunity to stay in the home. Because I think even a dad who's occasionally, say, smoking marijuana in this case is better than a dad who's in jail and leaving their kid in the home of a single mom. And because that's really tough. Parents and kids need moms and dads. Now, I think the reason I say I think I regret this is because a lot of people who are, quote unquote, in jail for just smoking marijuana, etc., that's not true. It says that, but that was a plea down from something way worse. So it's very disingenuous to say, oh, there's so many people in jail for just smoking marijuana. There's nobody in jail for that. It just says that because it was probably them dealing drugs and doing a host of other terrible stuff, and they plead down to a lesser crime. So I think I made a mistake there. I'm not entirely sure. But that was my only other, I don't know, success, other than changing some minds about people with economic things. But yeah, there you go. That's the summary. So nothing terribly impressive. It was a number of years ago, kind of some amateur lobbying. And I would advise you guys to take a swing at that too. If you can influence people in the right direction, do it. All right. Now this is the big mailbag question we have coming up. And I know you've all been wrestling with it. It's kind of everywhere these days, I think. Certainly lodged in our minds, and not to be pried out without, I think, this answer that you're supposed to get. Maybe even today. What are cooler, cars or dinosaurs? And listen, I too am plagued by this question and how one could possibly answer it. So here's what I did. I dug first into the etymology of the word cool. And indeed, it's pulled from an analogy to temperature. And a helpful article by Mike Valerhu from Slate explains, at its simplest, cool is neither hot nor too cold. And it's with this meaning that the word initially slipped into our language from its cognates in Dutch and German. It appeared originally as C-O-L, cool, which can be found as far back as the 9th century, when someone translated the poetry of the Roman philosopher Boethius from Latin into English, and for a long time couldn't quite figure out how it wanted to be spelled. We toyed with C-O-U-L, cool, flirted with C-O-O-L-E, and even went through a K-O-O-L-E phase, long before the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company figured out how to brand menthol cigarettes with sophistication, did it finally settle on cool, C-O-O-L. So there you go. The cigarette company fixed this spelling thing for us. And the Germans seem to have passed us this word. So what does this have to do with the dinosaurs and the cars? Well, I think it gives us a way of analyzing this question. Which one was actually cooler? Since it is derived from this temperature sense, let's ask the question. Now, you may be thinking, well, dinosaurs were cold-blooded. But you'd be wrong. It turns out, in fact, that most dinosaurs were warm-blooded. If we analyze the growth rate based on the growth rings in their bones, scientists can further estimate their metabolic rate. And again, testing the bones, the quantity of oxygen uptake can be chemically estimated, giving us another independent means of determining their metabolic rates. And some dinosaurs had faster metabolisms than mammals. And they're actually up there with modern birds, occasionally going so far as to qualify not just for being warm-blooded, but hot-blooded. But this has to be a fair comparison. What about cars? Now, certainly you're thinking, well, the engines are hot. Yes, but that's a bit unfair, as the engine is only a portion of the car. So to account for this, I took the average running temperature of a Corvette's engine. And I took the curb weight, and I figured out the average temperature of a car running on a 70-degree day. The result is an average temperature across the whole of the car of 82 degrees Fahrenheit, which is cooler than a dinosaur. However, I can always already hear the objections coming. The question was dinosaurs in general. So aren't you going to average down the temperature of dinosaurs by including the cold-blooded dinosaurs in your calculation? Yes, obviously I am. But here's the thing. It won't help because even the internal body temperature of a cold-blooded large herbivorous dinosaur in the Jurassic period, for example, is 37 degrees centigrade, or in real degrees, almost 97 degrees Fahrenheit due to the very warm tropical environment and the fact that even cold-blooded animals are slightly exothermic. So I don't think averaging that will actually help to average down the total temperature of those warm and hot-blooded dinosaurs. So on a pure temperature basis, if we're going to take this question very literally, it turns out that at least in most areas of the globe, cars are in fact cooler. But what about in a more abstract, poetical sense, a more metaphorical sense? Well, I've come up with a few excellent tests to determine coolness. Here are the three ways you know something is cool. Way one, would a 9-year-old want it on their birthday cake? And for this test, I'd say it's inconclusive. Cars versus dinosaurs. I could see going either way, so we're just going to say this one's a wash. The next test, this one may even be more powerful. If you ran low on poker chips and you had to wager this thing, how dramatic would betting it be to your fellow players? And here I think it's a clear and unequivocal win for the dinosaur. If you imagine someone saying, well, I have in my possession a dinosaur. The shock. That's way better than a car, really of any type. So this one is a win for the dinosaur, but there's a third test, and this might actually be the most important, because coolness is determined essentially by the popularity of popular people, making it popular. So I took top10.com's ranking of the coolest people to ever live. Let's go through it. According to top10.com, the number one coolest person ever, and this may surprise you, is Jesus. Yes, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ is indeed the coolest person of all time. And what would he prefer? Well, obviously dinosaurs. He created all things, dinosaurs included. He literally invented the dinosaurs. So I'm going to give him dinosaurs. All right, the second coolest person, Bruce Lee. Now, famously, he has the movie Enter the Dragon. And in Chinese culture, dragon is synonymous with dinosaur. In fact, the idea of dragons in China came from excavating for buildings and aqueducts and whatnot. Not aqueducts, whatever. Excavating for things which make sense. And they found different dinosaur bones, and they called these dragons. So, Bruce Lee saying, enter the dragon, is essentially enter the dinosaur. And I've never heard him say anything about entering cars. So, Bruce Lee has chosen dinosaurs. So what about number three? Who is Eminem? Slim Shady, if you will. Well, one would think that he would be Team Dinosaur, since he released the hit song Godzilla. And Godzilla is, well, we would assume a dinosaur, one that, of course, attacks Japan, as any living dinosaur would do. But in his hit song Rap God, he instead identifies himself with a car, stating, and I quote, "The way I be racing around the track, call me NASCAR, NASCAR." And famously, he raps at what he calls, quote, supersonic speed, where it goes, well, let me see if I can remember for a minute. You assuming I'm a human, what I gotta do to get it through, I'm sipping him an innovator mid-rebus so that anything you say is ricocheting off of me, including him, devastating more than ever, demonstrating how to give a mother effing audience a feeling like levitating, never fading, know the haters off ever, waiting for the day that they could say a fella if they be celebrating, cause another way to make them motivated, I make elevator music, you make elevator music, oh, he's too mainstream, well, that's what they do when they get jealous, they confuse it, it's not hip-hop, it's pop, cause I found a head of way to fuse it, with rock, shop rock, with doc, throwing the stuff and make it lose it. And it goes on, though, you know, not at that speed, because, well, if you had your stopwatch handy, you'll notice that I shaved off a quarter of a second. I think I'll use that quarter of a second right now for a message for Eminem. It goes like this. Get on my level, poodle! Sorry, guys, it's just the Book of Obadiah. It gets me so fired up. But we're going to get back to this list, because we're only at number three. All right, number four is Chuck Norris. His choice between cars and dinosaurs is trucks. But I guess I'll just lump that into cars. Number five, Michael Jackson. Well, you know that if he could make that little place of his there with the roller coaster and everything, if he could put a dinosaur over there, well, that'd make a zoo real cool. So I'm going to say Michael Jackson would do some dinosaurs. Definitely picking dinosaurs. That's Michael. Let's see. Who's number six? Arnold. Arnold Schwarzenegger is definitely picking between cars and dinosaurs, Hummers. Which again, Arnold, you can't just say Hummers. You'd have to say car, you know, whatever. But we're putting him in the car category because he's picking Hummers. Number seven, people think The Rock is cool. I'm not entirely sure they're right, but I did like his work in the fantastic animated film Moana. And I think that the way his character can be portrayed is he can be portrayed kind of like a personification of the powers of capitalism, which amazingly come to the rescue to solve the problems of this awful failing socialist island. And capitalism has given us cars. Therefore, I will say The Rock would choose cars. If we asked Tom Cruise, I think he'd say jet planes. No, you can't pick that. Aliens. No, my cult leader. Stop, Tom. Try harder. Okay, hell, dinosaurs. So we're putting him in Team Dinosaurs. Number nine, coolest person of all time, according to this list, which may or may not be accurate, but they got Jesus right, is Mick Jagger. And this one is incredibly easy because, as you all know, there is a recently discovered fossil that was named after Mick Jagger. Now, they almost named it after after Angelina Jolie, but they went for Mick Jagger. And I think if you've had a dinosaur, really any fossil named after you, it's clearly going to be preferable, even to the coolest car. Interestingly, this particular fossil was described as being like a, quote, slender hippo. Number 10, Will Smith. Now, seeing him in his groundbreaking documentary, Men in Black, I noticed he has an affinity for cars. So I'm going to put him in the cars category. Now, for those of you who are keeping track at home, you'll notice we're 5-5. And I promise I did not plan to have a tie. This is just the way it has split. So to solve this tie, here's what I've done. I've created a cumulative score whereby if you are ranked number one, so Jesus's pick, he gets a score of 1 applied in his category. And if you are second place, you get a 0.9 and down the line. When we score this, it turns out it's 2.7 versus 2.1, a victory for dinosaurs, proving definitively dinosaurs are cooler than cars. And that's just science. Next question. What do you think about scented candles? Well, I find them incredibly ironic. I want to know, how do they do it? All right, let me explain. I could find you a bevy of neurotic Beckys and Britneys that look aghast at even a simple, innocent paraffin found in their shampoo. But this same Becky will light a seashore linen cloud-scented candle. Becky will light a veritable bucket of paraffins on fire, and she'll huff the chemical lace smoke like an animal, like a slender hippo. Scented candles get the basic white girl plenary indulgence for all chemical sins and defenses. Now, I can just hear it. But Jake, they're soy-based candles, and they're natural. But here's the thing. They still make VOCs, soot, and a tar-like substance very similar to tobacco smoke, even if they are soy-based. You may be asking, are you saying that these aren't safe? No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying they're perfectly safe, but there's also a myriad of things that you're likely avoiding right now because they are, quote, chemicals, and they're probably safe too. So, bottom line, what do I think about scented candles? Well, I think they're lovely. I like a Macintosh-scented candle for the fall, or even a cinnamon spice. I do try to be careful with vanilla, as it can strike a bit artificial at times. For the season now, I might suggest a woodwick. I know, we're kind of on the edge of the season, but a sandalwood or an evergreen could gently fade us into spring from this dreary winter weather. So that's what I think about those. Two more questions. Android versus iPhone. The answer here is BlackBerry, the BlackBerry Z10 in particular. But alas, the grass withereth, the flower fades, the heathen nations rage, and the BlackBerry has been trampled underfoot, specifically by those lining up for the new iPhone releases. But since they're gone, I'm just going to say that Android is better. Voice text on an Apple is about as accurate as having your grandma make a transcription from the next room over. And Apple's Maps is so bad that if actual Apples used it, they would never find their way from the branch to the ground. Furthermore, a recent poll by the Daily Mail showed that 70% of women prefer to date iPhone users. In another poll, only 65% of Apple users would consider dating an Android user. Talk about bigotry. So, if you're trying to pick up chicks, proudly display your Android because you don't want any of those bigoted harpies. You deserve better, dear listener. Finally, what animal would make the worst pet? I would say the blue-ringed octopus. The problem is, these are a very enticing option in the world of pets. They have been described by many as, quote, cute. And that's because they are. What you may have thought is that you found the cheat code in the world of pets, a creature as easy to care for as a goldfish, yet as smart and entertaining as a friendly dog. But woe to those who consider this choice. First, your would-be friend requires a very expensive and cumbersome saltwater setup, far more work than you are currently envisioning. Next, these are truly smart creatures, and you are not their owner. You are their jailer. It's simply mean to trap such a smart little beast in a tank for your own enjoyment. But all of that aside, one day you will reach in to play with your little blue-ringed friend, possibly to pull him out to show him the wafting aroma of your new paraffin bonfire, and you will be betrayed. You will be betrayed Israel and Edom style. And here's how. Pulling from Wikipedia, the blue-ringed octopus, despite its small size, carries enough venom to kill 26 adult humans within minutes. Their bites are tiny and often painless, with many victims not realizing they've been envenomated until respiratory depression and paralysis begins. No blue-ringed octopus antivenom is available. So, stay safe out there, gang. All right. Well, we're going to end this episode here. And this is a reminder to rate and review this show. Do all three. Rate, review, and share this show. Do all three of those. After all, what more do you people want from me? I've now given you three groundbreaking line-by-line biblical commentaries covering Leviticus, Jonah, and now Obadiah. Solved the great and vexing question that humanity has long been facing, cars versus dinosaurs, outwrapped Eminem, and possibly saved the lives of a would-be octopus owner and his or her closest 25 friends. Lord, save me from your people. Just go and review and share and rate the podcast already. But seriously, guys, thank you very much for joining me. This was a surprisingly fun episode to whip up, and I always enjoy doing it for you. Hope you join me for the upcoming episode next week. Remember to reach out to me anytime with comments, questions, mailbag questions. Always enjoy those. Or just to introduce yourself. Tell me where you're listening from. Tell me what you've been liking. Anything at all, guys. Reach out to me anytime. The email is in the show notes. It's thegordianknot101@gmail.com. God bless. Talk to you next time.